Welcome to Everyday Driver, where cars are more than just transportation. They're freedom, a common ground, a way to grow, and can even make life better. We're here to help everyone find a car they love
and discover all the ways they connect us. I'm Paul.
I'm Todd. And this is The Car Debate.
Haven't done this in a while, but we are currently traveling for production for the show.
Yeah, you can probably tell the audio quality is not quite what we're used to because we're not in the studio. We're traveling, as Todd said. We're doing two TV episodes for season 8. So we're getting work done, but we're on the road and podcasting to you guys. So thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
We've got a really cool topic Tuesday from Nick asking a question about, broken down sports cars and why they might be better, or are they gone forever, is part of his question. And then after the break, we'll also have Frank writing in about crashing a car, and he's so embarrassed, crashing a car he loved. But that means, what does he replace it with? Plus, you guys are bombarding us with lots of great questions. That's coming, too.
Yep, agreed. Well, we've got to just jump in right to our topic Tuesday. This is Nick writing to us. And he says, I've started my own British Jank Challenge. I referred to that a few podcasts back, a few episodes back. What happened was, is that Nick bought a mid-70s Triumph Spitfire for very cheap, and he's been thrashing it around every back road he can find. And he says, by thrashing, I mean driving flat out and still struggling to keep up with the base model Jettas and Prii.
Yep.
If there was a British car problem, he probably would have won it in his first 2 weeks of ownership.
He's had it all. My favorite, actually, he said he's worked on just about everything he can think of, just about every car, part of the car has been touched. His favorite, though, and he's pointing it right at me, his favorite, though, is he's had electrical problems, thanks to Lewis Electrics, which are historical British electrics in cars that were awful. My favorite joke ever, and there are many, is Lucas, get home before dark. But he's had to fix two things, the headlights and the windshield wiper motor, because those are both provided by Lucas Electric. So he has done, honestly, just about everything to keep this car running, but he's able to drive it flat out and not care about it, which is fascinating.
He says he had some bad misfiring because of all the things. The clamp for the distributor was loose, which causes the entire distributor to rotate under heavy throttle, which throws off the timing because, of course, it does.
Are you changing the timing? No, I'm just moving the throttle.
It's just hard acceleration changes the timing. It causes the misfire.
That's amazing, honestly. Yeah.
Well, so he bought the car because he wanted something to drive quickly and spiritedly without the fear of speeding tickets.
Sure, sure.
It has been perfect on some of the twisty mid-state New York roads where Nick is. Low speed limits, but plenty of sharp turns through the woods and mountains. And he says the steering is a little vague until it bites, till the tires bite, and then the car dives into corners with almost no effort despite having no power steering. But now, because it's so underpowered, he can drive at 9/10 everywhere with this great little carbureted motor singing and snarling, he says, hilariously sliding the small tires around sharp corners.
I'm glad you can get tires for it.
He says the last tenth is reserved specifically for glancing over at the temperature gauge and keeping distance because he doesn't have power brakes.
Wow. All right.
Well, so he's starting to work towards the overall question. Mm-hmm. But he says, I understand the car is objectively terrible.
It's the car. Nick has the car that his wife kind of goes, why do you have that? It's one of those conversation cars where it's just like, why do you have this again? And those of us that are car people, we have things that people that aren't car people look at and just go, but why do you like that? I mean,
yeah,
I'll give you a couple from our life.
Car enthusiasts would, at first glance, think, now, what are you doing?
Yes, but I think it's the non-car people that really question. I mean, I'll give you two great examples. Chance, who shoots for us, is on this trip with us.
Yeah.
He has that 996 with a crazy loud exhaust, and he loves it.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. I have a Lotus Elise, which, honestly, by any normal, I'm going to drive and do normal things measure, is terrible. But yet, as a driving tool, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
So if you zoom out, and that's kind of what Nick does. Nick is aware enough to zoom out and be like, from all the kind of normal standard, I need a car to do things. It's awful. It's slow to accelerate. It doesn't stop well. There's no AC. Stuff keeps breaking. He's aware of the fact that by a normal metric, this is a bad car. But it doesn't take away the fact that he loves it. Because he loves the handling, he knows that if he measured against his like a normal GTI, it's awful, but he drives it and loves it so much, He doesn't care.
Oh, Nick, you've got me laughing because it says the low curb weight of 1,700 pounds is a lie because he's still afraid to leave home with all the entire trunk, he says, weighed down with tools.
He takes it all with him, yep.
Which is hilarious. Highway driving is terrifying, apparently, because this thing is tiny. And he thought he spotted a new type of crossover, but turns out it was just a Corolla that he was looking up at.
Of course he was.
A Corolla. You're looking up at a Corolla. But on the other hand, this car has been the most emotionally satisfying driver experience he's ever had. The analog feel of everything is imperfect but tangible.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much response in everything. The car communicates with you in every action taken. The four-speed manual, he says, is long throw but gives you a satisfying thunk you can feel in your fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
He says the styling, the noise, the feel are an emotional experience, and even his Minister of Finance loves it, despite
the fact
that's actually
very cool.
She has to immediately shower to get the gas smell out of her hair. Which all leads us to the question for Topic Tuesday, and that is, do we think manufacturers will give us, the collective we, the royal we, us
those
enthusiasts,
of us that love cars, yeah, love driving,
will they give us more sports cars that are valued being more emotionally satisfying in style and sound and driving feel over being measurably good on paper? And if not, do we think it's more to do with the regulations and the crash rating and decibel restrictions, fuel economy numbers, or more of a human nature? That the few people who are buying sports cars tend to do from what seems to be like having something to prove, or being the best, or owning the best on paper, or 0 to 60 times, or whatever other metric that you use to measure car ownership and qualify that. Wow, what a deep question. First of all, Nick, I love that you are finding this tangible driving experience in a terrible car. Any car enthusiast would say, well, you know what you need to do is you need to do blank, blankety, blank, blank, blank.
Yeah, for sure.
Or maybe they say, ditch the car, leave it by the side of the road with a bumper sticker that says, this is an abandoned car, and move on to something better. But that's not what you've done. And I love that. Because everybody, well, not everybody, but it seems like when we produce a video and we've got a comparison of two cars, inevitably, the people who love car A will say, well, it would only win if you did the brake upgrade. Or if you did the throttle position change or the suspension or the whatever, it would be better. And we're thinking, that's fine, but where does that end? At what point does that, you know, we're off the cliff in modding cars. And, you know, we've talked endlessly about modding out of class. But you're suddenly sliding down this slippery slope of money and time and all this stuff to make it better, and that's not how the car was designed.
Well, that's always our discussion, is that when we do, when we take cars and we review cars, especially new cars, the only baseline that is comparable is how it came out of the factory. It's the only baseline, because that's where the car company said, okay, that's done now. But then, yes, there's always, any car that loses, there is always the person that owns the car, that loves the car, that comes along and says, if you guys only did fill in the blank, it would have won. What I like about that is it proves that all of you out there have a car you love, which I really like. But it does create a scenario where you're right. You can tune stuff indefinitely. I think, Nick, the interesting thing about your question is you're hoping that the burst of technology toward, let's be honest, autonomous pods that we're all imagining are coming. And they're not that close, but we're imagining that. But in the process, I will admit this, though, cars are becoming more distant. In the process of cars becoming more distant, more computer-controlled, less in need of us, if you will, is there an opportunity to fill in the part of the market that isn't being served, which is the analog stuff? And if you look at it, the only analog stuff recently, it's still rare, but it exists. You have stuff like, I'm sorry, I'm going to hit it again, the 86 and the current Miata and the stuff that is, at least in the modern time, surprisingly analog. But if you hop in a car from the 90s with a cable throttle and hydraulic steering, that recent stuff that feels analog doesn't feel that analog anymore. And Nick is in, like, the world of fire hose analog stuff, where everything is just, you know, you can feel that it was milled by somebody in a shop somewhere. He's talking old 70s British cars. A guy had a cigarette hanging out of his mouth when he built that car. Okay?
Probably so.
You know, and he only worked a four-hour day. I mean, this was a 70s British car, okay? That was built by men in a shed, yeah. Like Top Gear likes to say. So are we going to go back there? Nick, I don't think we are for two reasons. One, I do think that current crash regulations, current concerns of a company to be sued for not making a product safe enough is going to keep us away from that. But I also think your second point is much more insidious, and that is, if you don't make a, see my air quotes now, better car than the last one, there's nothing to market. You can't market it as better than the last because it doesn't do a 0-60 better. The only recent modern surprise
I can think of is the
latest gen Miata. When they released it, it wasn't as powerful as the one generation prior. And I was I'm still astonished they did that. But the trade-off was
they kind of fixed it by now,
smaller and lighter.
Yeah, yeah.
So the problem is, and I hate to say it this way, I hate to simplify it this much, but the marketing department needs a bigger number than last time. They need a improvement over the last gen. It needs to be bigger, more comfortable, with more technology, and by the way, it's more powerful and faster. If it's not those things, we have nothing to do. The marketing department is now bored. We need to earn a paycheck. I have to push something. We have to get people excited because it's bigger, better, whatever. There isn't a, well, this isn't as good as the last one, but we think it's better. It's not a marketing department choice.
Look what it looks like.
But I think as enthusiasts, we want you to scale it back, but giving us less, possible exception being Porsche who charges you more, giving us less is really hard to market as a good thing.
Okay, I see what you're saying. This is very interesting. All right, I'll touch on that first, and that is the marketing department looking at a specific car. But this era that we're in, I think there's opportunity for marketing departments worldwide for car companies to split the efforts and say, we've introduced this new model, or we've taken the theme of this prior model, because they're doing that with electric cars. They're essentially taking the old model and making it better, newer, faster, all the things you were saying.
The Hummer.
By making it electric.
Yeah.
If they have two directions now and they're saying, okay, we're going one direction with all the people movers, all the new tech, all that kind of stuff, but we're going this other direction too and splitting that off to be able to capture a feeling, there's some marketing spin in there. There's paragraphs.
There's an opportunity.
Marketing to be able to say, this feeling and this kind of pursuit is what we're going after. Mm-hmm. The man plus machine. And I will use Lexus as an example because, amazingly enough, if you can believe it, Lexus sent us a VR headset. They sent us VR goggles loaded with the presentation. Now, Lexus could have said, well, here's a link to the video. Here, check out this video for the new car. Yeah. We're driving the LC500 convertible. And instead, they sent us preloaded with all the videos so you could look around and watch the presentation, but then everything else was a little bit interactive in a way to understand better what they were thinking. It doesn't matter what they're thinking, it just matters how it's delivered.
Well, and also, but you bring up Lexus, interesting, because Lexus has decided 30 years on that the next challenge for them is to create what they are calling the Lexus driving signature. Now think about this for a second. BMWs from the early 2000s all drove like BMWs. They didn't drive like Mercedes, they didn't drive like Porsches, they drove like BMWs. Now I think that's been watered down some since. But this is what Lexus is interested in. They want their cars to have a personality that is interesting to drive, which is not something Lexus has done really before. And at the same time, they want them all to feel like they are related in driving experience. They are pursuing that. But back to Nick's point here, they aren't going simpler in the process.
No, no. I think about manufacturing. So I want to bring up manufacturing too. And that is the shapes. First of all, let's start with style. The shapes that you see on the 30s and 40s and 60s cars, those were made because of the tools and techniques used to make them weren't as sophisticated as the tools we have nowadays.
Great point. Yeah,
that's why they look so beautiful and so clean and simple. You don't see the creative stamping, and that's why, by virtue of tech, in the manufacturing process, designers have had more things to pursue. You can add extra lines and extra things on it.
Whereas, hard creases and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, the 60s Maseratis and Alphas and Ferraris and all those beautiful Italian cars, they're just sort of swollen shapes covering up fenders, and you sort of enclose the people in this swollen bubble shape and give it some style and a little bit, but you don't want to go too far, and you can't make it too crisp and, you know,
you had to make it on an English wheel. You had to be able to round it all off and pound it out yourself, for sure. Yeah,
that's just by virtue of the tools.
Yeah.
Now
think
of all the modern milling and injection molding and additive manufacturing processes we have now to be able to make things, versus then when you bought your car, Nick, they're making castings and they're kind of filing stuff. They're cutting stuff out of metal, and that's just kind of how it goes together. And I don't want to spend more time and effort to make it fancier or more expensive, because that cuts into the cost of the car, how much it costs to make the car. So we got to keep that cost down. So what's the minimum I can do so it doesn't break immediately? And here's this part. Okay, we'll make it out of metal. Well, now we can make things out of injection molded plastics. And now the kinds of plastic materials we have available that are even stronger are astounding. So it, all that kind of stuff are things designers have to know. Engineers, you know, sort of live in that world already, but designers have to know this kind of stuff to be able to design something and propose something. Mm-hmm. Here's how I'm thinking this will go together. But back then, the governmental regulations worldwide were not nearly as intrusive enough.
Interesting, yeah.
To, you know, to what we're dealing with now. Well, in the name of safety, it's not just seatbelts anymore. We've got to go really far. We've got to go, you know, wiring harnesses and sensors and airbags and all that kind of stuff, electronics all over the car, which creates weight and creates bulk and mass to enclose the safety, the sensors, all that kind of stuff.
Think about how boxy front ends of cars across the board have gotten. That hasn't been just a weird designer idea. It's not a weird designer idea somebody had, and everybody, we should copy that. It's because of the pedestrian crash standards that have been created that have brought the hoods up away from the engine blocks. Mm-hmm. And so now everything has a box front end. That's not a weird trick. That is a regulation being implemented that has changed car design. That doesn't relate to the driving, but it does relate to what you're talking about, how all of these new technologies combined with the desperate need, and I put that in quotes because it's important, but sometimes it is almost too paramount, the need to make the car safer than the last version has now created, okay, well, look at how far away we are from, because how far away we are from that old great stuff. Because honestly, if you think about it another way, some of the old great stuff we're talking about was also pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, I know I've brought this up before, but I think about it when I drive my Lotus, which was obviously, honestly, in the U.S., on an exception, car maker exception, which is why it was in the U.S., and the reason they stopped putting it in the U.S. is because the U.S. changes its regulations to ask for dual-stage airbags that actually inflate at two different levels depending on the severity of the crash. Lotus didn't want to spend the money to do that, or couldn't do it for the Elise, so they stopped selling it in the U.S., and the Evora, they stopped selling for a year or two until they figured out the airbags for that car. So my point here is, there are definitely times when I drive the Lotus and I think, front end of this car is not going to hold up real well if I hit something.
Yeah.
If you go back to the cars from the 60s, drive an old E-Type. Yeah. Drive an old 911,
Sure.
You suddenly feel like you're in a spindly little thing.
You feel vulnerable, yeah.
You are, okay? Yeah. But on the other end of the spectrum, back to Nick's driving experience, it's so involving. Mm-hmm. You're so alive in it.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we're all craving. That's the bring a trailer effect. That is the old car effect. When people discover that, like you have, Nick, we're not going back to that time. We're not
going
back to
that era. Sadly, I don't think so either,
of feeling that way because of all the new regulations. Mm-hmm. And that's just how things were made. What you're feeling, the gear shifts and the way it interacts, that's just how it was made. Mm-hmm. That's not a deliberate thought process necessarily on the part of the car manufacturers thinking, well, let me make something that you're really going to be involved with. Over time, engineers want to engineer the feel out of it so it's smoother and better. And we're no longer using straight cut gears. We're using helical cut gears,
yeah,
so they engage
better
and they're smoother and you don't feel it. And we're trying to get away from all that feel.
I'll give you two other examples outside of cars where, quote unquote worse is better.
Okay.
Vinyl records and film photographs.
We were just talking a lot about music
about
over
those.
Dinner.
Yeah,
we were
yeah.
just talking about and just music and the recording
if
media.
If you've ever heard your favorite album on vinyl, whoever you are, there, and you don't even need to be an audiophile, I'm just saying, think of your favorite album. Have you ever heard it on vinyl? I feel confident in saying to you, it was a dirtier, less clean recording than when you've heard it before on digital.
Certainly, certainly.
But it has a quality to it. That's interesting. It's not better, but it's engaging.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
true of cars. And film, actual photographs taken on film and movies shot on film have this same effect.
Yeah.
And I'm the movie guy for sure, but there is something about the reality of the way color gets captured on actual motion picture film that feels fundamentally different than it does shot on digital. And there's some, well, please don't get me wrong, I am not a guy that's like, digital is bad. We shoot on digital. Digital can look phenomenal. Color correction is amazing. You can make it look wonderful. But if you've ever seen this, this is a random one. If you see Westerns, Western film shot on digital, it doesn't look right. It looks weird. In the same way that I think sci-fi films actually look better shot digital. Side note. But my point here is, why on earth would a film on shot on film ever be more interesting to watch than something shot on the latest thing where it's super clear and it's digital? Because there's a something about the analog in all of these things. Music, film, cars. Something about the analog part of it that isn't done with ones and zeros. It sucks us in more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's not even something we really can quantify, but I think it is a universal thing. As we as humans progress into more digital everything, we are losing tactile touch points that keep us engaged and intrigued.
Absolutely. I don't want to just talk about that arena, Nick. I want to look forward to what is coming. And I am a firm believer that the best design can come out of the most restrictions. If you have a blue sky, clean sheet of paper, you know, all those cliches that you say, all right,
sure, sure.
From the very beginning, you're not going to produce as good of a result as if somebody's handing you a lot of restrictions you've got to work around.
Mm.
You've got to engage your brain more. You've got to really think about, you know, how am I going to get around this and solve that need? If you've got a long list of restrictions, of course there's a balance there. It can't be so long that it's, wow, this is impossible and, you know, here's a box. That's your solution kind of thing. But if you've got a lot of restrictions, then I think some of the best ideas and the best design can be pushed from that. It can come out of that, essentially. Because, like I was telling you, we have all these new manufacturing processes that never before were available, that have nowhere been close to being used to their fullest potential yet. And I'll give you an example. When I was in the tech industry, there was some new software. It is starting to be more ubiquitous at this point, but it's lightweighting software. It's essentially taking the same form language and, by calculations, using the software to lightweight it, to take mass out of it while still retaining the same strength of the material it is.
You're kind of Swiss cheesing it, but to proper specs that it stays strong.
It's difficult for a human to calculate
the
strength points. So what you do is you enter the points of strength, say a chassis. So you put these points in, and these are the hard points that cannot move. And then you let the software calculate the in-betweens of these points. Now, you can adjust it. Think of it as sliders. You can adjust it one way, and you'll say, all right, I need this to, you know, support this much, you know, torsional rigidity and a force of this amount in this direction, say vertical direction.
Sure, sure.
And it needs to support this much weight. And so those are your inputs. And then you'll allow, and different points on the chassis, on the vehicle, will require different inputs.
Sure.
Some might not need to be quite so robust. They can be a little bit lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll let the solver, the computer, do the solve.
Mm-hmm.
This is all called generative design. And the computer can come up with millions of iterations.
Sure.
But you're looking for what's the right in between, where because it'll add more material. Ooh, that's getting too heavy.
Sure.
But then on the other hand, how do we make that? Mm. Okay, let's move the sliders back the other way. Let's go this direction.
Okay, yeah.
And so we haven't even begun to tap into this kind of potential yet. It's starting to be used when, again, I was with Autodesk and I was working for that company, and they were starting to show this around to companies like aerospace companies and Ferrari in particular was using this and say, all right, we need this to be look like this, but we need it to actually be sculptural and beautiful and let the computer generate that.
Hmm.
And it was 13 pounds and now it's 6 or 7 pounds.
Wow.
On the other hand, it's more expensive because you're having to do industrial manufacturing,
additive
manufacturing
sure.
to get to that crazy shape that a 20-axis mill couldn't even come close to designing.
Got it. Yeah.
So now that we have that and we're starting to use additive manufacturing, I think there's so much more potential to meet all the requirements that you're talking about for the future, safety and regulations and blah, but also to make something new that we've never felt before. And we're using the same kinds of materials as the old school. It's still iron and steel and aluminum. It's just made in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that future is what marketing teams can now tap into to say, made in a different way, and it has a particular thought in mind to capture the essence of whatever we're going for.
Mm-hmm.
Lexus driving signature is what they have gone after. But many car companies will use that to define their own future, their own, what are we going after? And so I don't think these sports cars, as this feel, is ever going to be ignored. It's never going to be we're not going to pay attention to that. Maybe some companies might, but other companies are going to want to get to the crux of driving. And
I hope so.
Is it fun to be in this car? We make all the autonomous and the stuff and the tech and great, but over here is this core thing. Now, they also have to come to grips with, it's not going to sell in volume.
Yeah.
They have to be okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
As we've discussed in prior episodes, Toyota is perfectly okay with the Supra not selling as well as the CHR or the Corolla or the RAV4 or any of their other vehicles.
Yeah.
They're fine with that, and they've still invested the money.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we all say Toyota, as enthusiasts, what is the first car you think of? The Supra. Well, maybe the 86 for you, but you know.
Or the Land Cruiser if you're an off-road.
Or the Land Cruiser.
Yeah, but I take your point.
You know what I mean. I'm just using it as
a halo name. Yeah, totally it is. Absolutely.
So what are manufacturers going to do to start integrating new manufacturing techniques into building something? And when the marketing people and the project planners come and say, what are we going to do next to light a fire under the brand? We've got all the people movers. We've checked all the boxes. How can we make more sales? How can we bring people to this brand? What is this new thing we're going to come up with? I bet you, I'm willing to bet significant amounts of money that they'll come to use this, you know, whatever emerging technologies are, which car manufacturers are very much pursuing, as are aerospace and any industrial manufacturing, to try to get to a better goal to meet all these requirements. It's going to look different. It's going to feel different.
Yeah.
But that was the same thing applied then to 70s. We can't do a forging. We can only do a casting.
Okay.
And then we can do the fly cut face of that thing. And that's about as good as it gets. And it's going to feel kind of rough, but it stays within the project brief.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be at a certain price point, and it feels awesome and mechanical now. No, we just made it so it could be cheap enough to make the thing.
You're
thinking about all this mechanical.
You're reminding me of something you've said before, and that is, we do hope, Nick, we genuinely hope that as car companies get more into, because they've always done this, they're not charity organizations, they're going to sell what people buy. As they get more into CUVs and, you know, autonomous stuff and electric stuff that is theoretically volume, or if you will, it's the future that they see they can push. I do hope that factions break off in these companies that want to make something just for drivers. And they do split their product lines so that you have all the normal stuff and then you have the outliers. And you bring up Toyota. Toyota's kind of doing this right now.
Mm-hmm.
But here's a thought for you real quickly. Can any of us think off the top of our head, what was your favorite Mazda before the Miata came out in 89? That car's 30 years old. The interesting thing about the Miata is think about the Miata, Nick, in relation to your 70s car. The Miata was Mazda, who was not a big player, sitting down and going, let's make a roadster like all those old roadsters. Now we just think of the Miata. It's existed forever. It's always been. But in the late 80s, there was nothing like that but the, from the stuff from the 60s and 70s. And all of that stuff didn't run. Mazda puts a stake in the ground and said, we've made something. They based it on the Lotus Elan.
Yeah.
Okay, not known for its reliability.
It's a 70s car.
Yeah. But they dropped this new roadster in the old thinking, but the new version of the old. And it became an icon.
Yes.
Let's hope that happens again, Nick. When everything is as uninvolving as possible, let's hope car companies are throwing down the new version of the old feel.
Yes.
But then the trick is, we have to buy it.
We, the collective we, have to go buy it.
When
let's
it's
hope
new.
They're good, but when they are good, we can't ignore them.
We have to buy them.
And be like, oh, I'm still looking for old 2002s
on
Bring a Trailer.
This is the internet problem.
No.
This is the internet problem because we go scream, scream, scream. This is what I want. This is what I want. We're such spoiled children. This is what I want, what I want, what I want. And a car company goes, oh, you mean like this? And we go, not like that.
Yeah.
Come on. Yeah. We got to buy this stuff.
Yeah, very true. I'm a glass half full kind of a guy, Nick. And I look at the stuff that I was describing to you is now 3, maybe 4 years old at the point of this recording as far as what the software can do. It has come a long way and started to be integrated more into various user programs. And it's democratized. It's cheap. Mm. Almost anybody can access it.
Yeah.
But you apply it to so many different kinds of problems. There were examples of chairs. And everybody knows a chair has to have four legs. And there's a certain amount of weight that's on it. But the generative design could generate so many different kinds of examples using these 4 points have to carry this amount of weight. And then it would just solve. It would just think. And you're moving the sliders and you're changing the points.
Wow.
Again, this is 3, 4 years old at this
point. Yeah, yeah.
And now it's going to be used a lot in the future. I see that.
Huh.
From the grill designs, you look at the front of a grill of a new Hyundai or Audi and you think, oh, that is... How did somebody model that? That seemed very painstaking. No, it's probably generative design.
Interesting. Okay. All
and
right.
That shape, you put in your, okay, I want six-sided, you know, next to a four-sided shape, and it has to be squished, and it has to be this long, and let it solve. Let it do it. So you put in your parameters, and then let it solve. So those of you listening who are in this industry, and you understand what I'm talking about already, you know, you've come across it. But this is just, the surface has yet to be scratched. In doing so. So the technology and manufacturing is going to push the things that we love to drive. So I look at this as very encouraging. It's just, they're going to look different. They're going to feel different. But I think they're still going to be fun in a new way and very interesting, engaging in a new way.
When you want to spend some time washing your car, but you're short on time, Griot's has two new ideas for fast and easy washing in your garage or driveway without rinsing. Try the Rinseless Wash and Wax Kit or the Waterless PFM Spray-On Car Wash Kit from Griot's Garage.
They're both great if the weather's gotten colder outside or you're an apartment dweller and you live in an area where hose and bucket washing is restricted or inconvenient.
You'll get a perfect wash, indoors or outdoors, in a quarter of the time it takes to wash a car normally. These kits are the no-hassle way to keep your car looking really sharp. Griot's Garage products are 100% guaranteed, and all their liquid products are made in the USA.
When you're ordering at griotsgarage.com, remember to use the code EVERYDAY for 15% off liquids and 10% off everything else. That's Griot's, G-R-I-O-T-S. Enjoy the finest quality car care products you can buy at griotsgarage.com.
When your car needs new brakes, it's a great time to upgrade for better stopping power. We're excited to partner with PowerStop Brakes for an easy way to get more performance from something you already need.
PowerStop is on a mission to deliver better brakes on every vehicle in every situation, from daily commuting to towing to track days. These are all bolt-on, direct-fit parts for better braking, no modifications required.
Every PowerStop complete brake kit comes with all the parts you need to upgrade your brakes, including pads, rotors, and even those little clips and fasteners. Plus, all their pads are made from a carbon fiber ceramic compound, which they've tested extensively to deliver low dust and noise-free performance.
So the next time you need brakes or you simply want to upgrade, visit PowerStop.com and enter your vehicle's information into their easy-to-use car finder. We even found great kits for our SUVs and our cheap sports cars. Give your everyday driver the easy and affordable performance upgrade it deserves at PowerStop.com.
The car debate is for poor Frank. And I say poor Frank because he is genuinely humiliated and ashamed. He had, that's the past tense, he had a 2017 Chevy SS manual that he loved. And he was driving it on a cold and rainy day about a week before he planned to put winter tires on it. And it all went wrong. And he met a concrete barrier. And it's pretty much dead.
Frank, we're very sorry to hear. It's never fun. And yes, it can happen to anybody.
Yes,
he says, this is weeks before he would have thrown on his winter wheels and tires. Frank's up in Rochester, New York. He says, physically, I'm 100% fine, but emotionally crushed, as he loved this car like a newborn child. Now, he's a bit of a serial car buyer, as he's owned six cars in the last 6 years. He also works for General Motors, but he's not entirely beholden to the brand.
Okay.
Previous cars include a 2017 Focus RS, a Chevy Colorado diesel from 2016, a Chevy Silverado, a Cadillac ATS, and a 1999 BMW 328i manual.
Okay.
At this point, he hasn't gotten final word from the insurance company, but he says all in, assume a budget of about $40,000.
Okay.
And his girlfriend has a 2018 Silverado for towing her horse. So he has sufficient GM content or currency to buy with confidence outside his home.
He cannot buy a GM and still feel like he's like, right, I have my GM over here. Yeah, totally.
Frank is proven to be a car enthusiast because he currently owns a 1988 Alfa Romeo Spider, which he's half restored.
I actually think the half restoring is what makes him the car enthusiast there. It's not that he owns the Alfa. It's the fact that he has a car in his garage that's half restored. Anyway, go on.
Exactly. He says, I've also got about six motorcycles, something like that. He's looking for another performance-oriented sedan. Must be rear-wheel drive-based platform. All-wheel drive's okay, but he didn't really like the front-wheel drive-based Focus platform. He plans to drive this all year round using snow, wheels, and tires in the winter.
Okay, got
it. He only works about 5 miles from his house, still manages about 20,000 miles a year, doing road trips and visiting parents in the greater New York City area.
Okay.
He has been spoiled owning mostly new cars, so this car needs to be new enough to have decent phone connectivity. I think we can solve that for you.
Yeah, but at the same time, if it didn't, and I think we'll solve it anyway, if it didn't, you can update almost anything short of a, you know, a Volkswagen Phaeton. You can replace your head unit in most cars and solve the problem.
It's true. Yeah, the Phaeton kind of resisted that, didn't it?
Because it had an old ancient brain, you couldn't bother the brain. Don't bother the brain. That will only lead to pain.
Well, he's also got a rowdy golden retriever who will need to fit in the back, so the rear should be spacious enough for the occasional rear passenger. Now, even though he said I'm a serial car buyer, he was not yet done with his SS experience. So he loves the on-demand power, the glorious exhaust note, the sleeper status, and the practicality and comfort. First of all, the first question is, should he just get another SS? Now, he's open to replacing it as long as it's a manual. He says the automatic is hopeless. He's looking at first-gen Panamera turbos. He found one on CarMax for $46,000, but he says, I know there's cheaper ones out there. E36 Mercedes wagons?
Okay.
Interesting.
Pretty cool.
He'd prefer a manual car, but he could be swayed for a good automatic. And before you say it, what are we, foregone conclusions, Frank?
Apparently.
I hate being a foregone conclusion. He is not a fan of the Stinger. He hasn't driven one, but he has sat in one, was not impressed with the passenger space.
Okay.
Which is not uncommon, he says, because his girlfriend also enjoys driving. He's 28 years old, 6'4", 200 pounds. He's interested in, first of all, we need to answer the question, should he get another SS? But then, beyond that, what?
Well, look, we've said it before, when you have a car taken from you, when you get to like, I like this car, it's good, maybe I could sell it, start having those thoughts. Not because you don't like your car, but you're maybe I could sell this.
Mm-hmm.
You're okay, you're done enough. When the car is taken from you,
yeah,
a wreck, it's stolen, somebody hits it in a parking lot, doesn't matter what it is, I almost always feel like if you don't feel like you're done yet, go get another one. Now,
okay, fair,
Frank is a serial car buyer, though. So my question becomes, how much longer would you have had that car, Frank? And can you even say, was it on your mind to, I wonder what's next? Or were you just like, no, the SS is my bag?
And only Frank can answer that question.
Exactly. We don't have any idea. So right. I really wonder if, another SS is fine. The problem is, the one like you had, I think you're also going to compare a lot. There's not like there's a lot of them out there. And so
my old one was better. Yeah, this one's not as good.
I'm worried about that for you too. Unless you find, because there's not enough of them out there. It's just like, well, I'll just go get another one. You're going to have to look for a while to find another SS manual that checks all the boxes. So that's an interesting one. I do think another SS is a good choice. I love the Panamera. Don't go turbo.
Don't go turbo.
The problem is, look, and I don't know off the top of my head, but we know people that have bought them and had trouble. Look up the information about the recalls and the engine problems with the turbos, because it can be catastrophic. But I actually think go S or GTS and be happy.
Just go S or GTS. Telling you the GTS flavor.
You would like that a lot. Now, it's not a manual transmission, but you would like that car a lot. The Panameras are really cool. Enough space for the dog in the back. The E63 wagon, that's a discerning choice. that's the car journalist choice right there. Those are so much fun.
I like that. Frank, I have your car, though. Just one.
Do you?
I went shopping.
Couple more, but please tell me what you found. Tell me what your shot is.
At our friends, autotempest.com.
Okay.
I typed in my requirements, and I found many. The nicest one that I found so far is over a decade old, but that's okay, because I am here to save you money. I know you're shocked. $40,000. I went shopping for an E90 BMW M3, the sedan, with a manual V8, built from 2008 to 2013, and I found you one, an 08 M3 in black, 33.9. In Pasadena, California, actually where I used to live.
Cool.
52,000 miles. It looks gorgeous. Oh, ooh.
It's funny because that was my, I think this gets it done car as well.
That means
you need to go drive it, Frank, because I was going to say E90 four door as well.
Look how clean this thing is.
Very clean.
Look at that.
E90 four door with a 6-speed manual. Watch our BMW generational film called Icon, where
we drive that
E90 M3. It's an awfully good car, and it has, here's the thing, that SS that you had, Frank, had a great V8 engine and 6-speed manual combination. This is also a great one, and it feels totally different.
Look at this.
It's a really, really interesting
V8. There's many on Autotempest. Most of the ones I found have between 60 and 90,000 miles, so it kind of depends the year, the mileage, the maintenance, all that stuff. But you have a plethora of choice, which is lovely.
They're really good.
Oh. I love the proportions on the sedans a lot better.
I agree with you. I think that was the one everybody thinks of, and this is that mid-2000s range. Everybody, thinks of the two-door. I think the four-door is where that car is. It's kind of magic.
I think so, too. And the good news is, because they're going to be a little bit higher mileage, but you're going to pay less, the commitment is going to feel like less of a commitment.
Interesting point.
Going to a new car, BMW, what's the maintenance going to be like, the fuel mileage, all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, I'm not spending as much as I probably spent on the SS.
Sure, yeah.
So that feels, it takes the sting out of it a little bit.
I see it. Yeah, yeah.
And again, depending on the car that you find and that you fall in love with, all of these are great. It just kind of leaves room for, okay, I didn't spend all my money. I know, all of you are saying, what did you do with Paul?
Paul didn't spend all the money? What's going on? Yeah.
Who is this guy talking to me on the podcast? But that is the one car that popped in my mind when you said all these requirements, there's nothing else. Because when you say a good automatic, really the one Todd and I know is the Alfa Romeo Quadrifoglio.
Yeah.
The Giulia Quadrifoglio.
That's a good
automatic.
And that, here's the thing. There's two cars on my wild card list, because I agree with you on the E90, completely agree. Two cars on my wild card list, and they're both there because legitimately you don't need 40, you need 50.
No.
And one of them is the CTS V wagon.
Todd's going to do it for me today.
Yes.
He's going to ruin
one of them is the CTS V wagon, and the other is the Giulia Quadrifoglio. And if you don't have 50 grand, you can't really go shop for
those
cars.
That's true.
At 40, I think the E90 is the play.
This is so tasty for 30.
They're so nice.
Okay, that's the nicest one I could find. But if you really want to go nuts, just visit enthusiastauto.com. Our friends there have lots of ridiculously expensive, beautiful.
They're gorgeous, but you will pay every dime.
They're the nicest. They're the choice.
They are the best, but they're almost going to charge you to look at the website. It's expensive at Enthusiast Auto. Yeah.
I'm looking at new ones.
Yeah, it's all bad.
Gorgeous stuff, but then just hang on, because you're going to look at the price thinking, oh, that looks clean. I can afford double what I was thinking.
It looks gorgeous, but oh man, that hurts.
But Yeah, they're good stuff. So, Frank, go check those out. Please keep us posted. We're very sorry that you crashed your car and that you were not quite done with it yet, and it could happen to anybody, but pick yourself up, dust yourself off. There's more lots of fun driving to be had, and you're off to a new experience.
Take a guess at the one thing we can't get enough of: car stuff. That's right. That's why we love Hagerty Drivers Club. Starting at $45 a year, you'll get 6 issues of the award-winning Hagerty Drivers Club magazine, which is chock full of interesting reads and beautiful photos.
You'll also get access to members-only live stream on topics that range from car values to automotive history, DIY tutorials, and a whole lot more. Plus, membership comes with tons of automotive discounts from big brands, including Deal of the Week, which is always an exclusive deal that only lasts a couple of days.
If you love cars, and we know you do, this club is for you. Learn more at Hagerty.com/everydaydriver.
Lots of good audience questions coming at us as always. Thank you guys for always responding when we ask for questions. It adds this fantastic little unique part to every show we do, because we never know to some degree what we're going to be talking about.
I mean, yeah,
we get all these great, great car debates you guys send in Topic Tuesdays, and thank you for doing that. EverydayDriverTV@gmail.com is the email address to send those directly, or you can go to the website, everydaydriver.com, go to the contact button under About. You can send stuff there. Both goes to the same place, same email address. We appreciate all of that. But then these questions create this kind of random wild card thing that happens every time. We just never know what we're going to talk about. It's great. I'm going to start here with Hal Bullock talking about car shows, specifically British car shows.
I'm glad you did, because I was going to come.
He's asking, why do we think that Top Gear is a more popular show than Fifth Gear? He looks at Fifth Gear and sees more of an actual car show, and he feels like a lot of the Top Gear stuff is more contrived and less car-focused. What do we think is going on? What do we think is better?
Okay.
Hal, first off, your assessment is correct. Fifth Gear is a superb car show. It is a show for car people to talk about cars.
Tiff Needell is back doing something.
He's been doing great stuff.
What's
here's the thing.
Doing now?
Tiff's the guy that taught Jeremy Clarkson how to drive well. Truthfully,
yeah.
I mean, Tiff
is a shoe.
Yes, Tiff was known to be fantastic to drift.
And everybody.
He taught Jeremy Clarkson how to drive like that, so that's funny.
That's funny.
But Fifth Gear has always been a focused car show, and Tiff was on Top Gear in the late 90s when it was canceled, and the other person on Top Gear at the time was Jeremy Clarkson.
Mm.
And then Clarkson reboots it as a different kind of show, and I'll get there in a second, and then Tiff goes off and creates Fifth Gear, okay? So Fifth Gear is a much better car show, but Top Gear is about spectacle. And if you're watching the updated versions they're doing now with Chris Harris and the other two British guys, Freddie Flintoff and Paddy McGinnis, if I'm getting it right, that show is so much about the spectacle. And
You're right.
Here's the thing, Hal, is Top Gear, under Clarkson and Willman, and carrying on now, even though they've gone on to do Grand Tour, they found a formula that made a car show broad for non-car people. And it is, in many ways, a show about drama, spectacle, or travel that happens to be related to cars. My joke forever about Top Gear is it's a travel show with a car problem. It's not the other way around.
Which is true. It's no longer a joke.
That's absolutely what Grand Tour is. Grand Tour is a travel show with a car problem. But the thing is, if you get non-car people, they're intrigued enough to watch it, and the car stuff they probably zoned out for. I'll go you one further, Hal, and this is frightening. When they did a U.S. Top Gear on the History Channel a few seasons back, years back, they did like 3 or 4 seasons, Rutledge Wood, Tanner Faust, and the third person, Adam Ferrara. Okay?
Ferrara, yep.
I knew an editor on that show in the first season.
Oh, Tim, what's his name?
Tim, exactly, was an editor on the show. Here's the interesting thing. They did audience testing. And the audience testing they did was the real-time testing. Now, if you've never seen or heard this, literally, you've got people in a room and they have a dial. And they turn it up when they like what they're seeing. They turn it down when it doesn't interest them or they get bored. And you're showing them the thing and it is real-time dials and data.
That's kind of weird.
Okay?
Wow.
When they were doing spectacle or travel, in general, the lines all went up. Everybody got excited when they did a car piece. And I remember in the first season, Tanner Faust did a 9/11 test at night in downtown L.A. where he was sideways for most of it. And it was brilliant.
That was really well shot.
Great driving, really well shot. Everything was great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That scored terribly all the dials turned down while they just did a car review. Because, now, I would love to know, and Tim didn't know this, I would love to know, where did they get the audience? I'm guessing it was an audience of non-car people. Top Gear is trying to be as broad as possible, which means you want non-car people to like it, and they don't like car reviews as much, so the dials turn down. But if we do spectacle and absurdity and travel, the whole family can watch. You don't have to like cars. That's the difference.
All right, Barrett Jero says, each of us can have a free car from 2020 that we have to hold on to for life. What car are you picking? This is way too easy for me.
Okay.
It is a C8 Corvette.
Oh.
Done and done and done.
Yeah, that's a great choice. That's a really strong choice.
We're done. Probably the convertible, and we're good.
That's a very strong choice. I don't know that I can top that. I do think a Miata RF is going to be timeless, though.
That'll be...
I think the C8 is fantastic. Yeah. I think in 20 years, the C8's going to feel old. I think in 20 years, the RF's going to feel classic.
Okay, that's a good distinction. I like that. I like that.
I think I'd go there.
The RF is... Oh, it's so compelling. It's always compelling.
RC Lowe's says, has the Giulia been around long enough to get a feel for its reliability? Would we consider buying a used one? You know what? I absolutely would. In spite of the fact that some of the press cars, when they were first out, some press folks had problems. And I say this not in a weird way, but we genuinely had no issues. We had a Quadrifoglio on track. We had a Quadrifoglio for a long test drive for a while. We put it up against an M3. We drove base models. Everyone we had worked flawlessly. We never had one hiccup. But yet Car and Driver had a long-termer that was terrible, and they also at one point had a press car that was terrible.
Yeah.
Everyone
we've had has been great.
Exactly. So honestly, we haven't had issues, but I know people that have bought them used. I think Derek actually has a Quadrifoglio right now that he loves. He bought used.
I'm glad. He should love it.
But we also had a couple of you wrote us early on in the first year of your ownership and said you weren't having any problems. And one of you had a theory, which I think is interesting.
Right, right.
That you think that the early press cars were under-batteried. I don't know that that's a term, but follow my point. They didn't have a heavy-duty enough battery, and that caused, as we've seen on the Maserati and other things, a series of gremlins because it didn't have enough battery power.
Yeah.
And this owner that happened to write us said that one of the first things he did was he put an upgraded battery in his car because he always does it. And it ran much better than it did before he did that. And he doesn't know, if that might have been the source of some of the gremlins for some of the press cars, which I wouldn't be surprised by.
Okay.
All of this to say, I would buy, and have, I must admit, looked, I would buy a Quadrifoglio. I would buy just a base Giulia if I was shopping in that market. They're excellent. I would buy one right now.
You're looking at Quadrifoglios, though.
I am. You're right. I can't begin to afford one because that's the one I want. But even every time I drive the base Giulia, great.
But here we are, 3 years after first driving one, almost more than that, three years.
Yeah.
Of driving the Quadrifoglio thinking, all right, 3 to 5 years is going to be the sweet spot for these cars. Here we are.
Here we are. I think it's time.
I agree. Indira says, how much should we consider occasional use cases when car shopping? For example, if what you use your car for most of the time is commuting around town and some driving for fun, but then you only go on a longer road trip maybe once a year, how much would you consider the road trip ability? Or would you just say, screw it, it's not worth it, considering I'll only use it that way occasionally? Ian, there is the factor of I just want it that none of us can ignore. You have a car or you want to buy the car, and it does check most of the boxes and it does most of the things, and clinically speaking, objectively speaking, it does all the things. But it leaves off the I just want it part. Whereas other cars come along and you think, oh, I've got to have that car. No, it doesn't match my thing and I'm breaking my own rules to buy it, but I want that car. That's the one you should buy.
Yeah.
You're going to love it more than the other one that just does all those boxes. I'm not saying checking all the boxes is bad, and sometimes it's tough to match everything you need and all the stuff you want in it too.
Yeah.
The cars that do that for you, don't sell those.
Yeah.
Keep driving those until you're absolutely sick of them.
Yeah, Ian, I'm going to build on this as well, and that is, this honestly, it relates to the thing we say about pickups. if you go to Home Depot once a quarter and you need a pickup for that once a quarter, but you don't need a pickup otherwise, don't buy a pickup. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can rent a pickup at Home Depot to haul all that lumber you do once a quarter. If you're going to take two road trips a year for maybe a grand total of 10 days, don't buy the car for the purpose of the 10-day road trip. I'll tell you a secret.
Right, right.
Rent something.
Yeah.
Because then you don't even put the mileage on your own car.
Exactly.
Often, it's surprisingly cheap to rent a car that returns back to where you rented it from for a week. If you start adding up, maybe you rent something that gets better gas mileage in your car. It's just savings right there. My wife and I have done this.
Right, right.
So I would say if road tripping is an occasional thing, but your car you want to drive for every other situation isn't good for road tripping, fine. If I was road tripping all the time, if that was what I did all the time, would I have a Lotus? Probably not. I've said this before. If I was sitting on the 405 stopped in a commute situation, I wouldn't own an Elise. This isn't how I drive. I love that car. Buy it. I love what your point, Paul, because you've got to buy the thing that you love, because then when the bill comes every month, you aren't angry about it. But the other part
or less
of it
angry.
Is, or less angry. You're less concerned. But the other part of it is buy it so you can use it at its best most of the time.
Okay, I like that. Alex HC09 asks, at what point does a company decide to change the corporate look?
Mm.
More specifically, when will Acura ditch the beak? Have you seen the new Genesis cars? They've looked at that shape and thought, I like that shape. Let's pick that up and do something with it. And it's kind of similar, even though it's oversized.
You're saying the Acuras kind of look like the Genesis?
The Genesis looks like the Acura with the new GV70, GV80.
Oh, interesting point.
It's taken that kind of...
That shield shape is similar. Shield, fair point, yeah.
It looks different because of their execution, their take on it, but you could find some similarities in it.
Yeah, it does look like they were looking around just a bit. That's a good point.
Proportionally, it's a little bit different, but otherwise, look at what they've done, and everybody says, oh, well, that looks great. The answer is, when sales are down, all things considered, when the sales numbers indicate, nobody's interested in our stuff anymore, they're just not liking how it looks, and isn't it amazing how much the looks of things drive sales of cars. Doesn't matter how much tech you dump into it. It matters, is it beautiful? Do I want that gorgeous thing in my life? I'm paying a whole lot for it.
Mm-hmm.
Do I want it in my life? Is that fun? Do I want to be seen in that? Is that me? And yes, cars can be considered a fashion item. Now, they're well built enough that you could have them almost forever, but now there's a lot to be said for the look of a thing. And when sales are down, the dealerships are going to let corporate know, and they're going to say, we're not getting the traffic, we're not getting the sales that we wanted. Their sales were up in the first 2 or 3 years of the model, and now they're down because X competitor is kicking us in the teeth over here with a better-looking car.
Yeah.
That's a lot of what it comes down to. They're not going to say, competitor X rides really better than our cars, but man, do our cars look great. You know, no, it's going to be, our cars are ugly. They look outdated. Mm. But you have to be careful when it comes to changing the corporate look. That's a different subject than just changing the style.
Yeah, we're going to change the lineup. You're right.
The whole corporate look, ooh, that's a big deal. That means you're capturing a new market or you're embarking on a new market never before attempted, like Genesis.
Yeah.
That you want a piece of.
Yeah.
That's when you change the corporate look.
Interesting. Speaking of Genesis and Hyundai and all of those things, Tanergy Images says, Volkswagen Atlas or Kia Telluride? He's narrowed things down to both of those. Clearly, you're looking for a 7-seater. You need a large car for a growing family. You acknowledge that we have an Atlas that we've recently drove. We did. We're actually driving two versions. We're waiting to do the test drive after we've driven both. However, you're asking, which do we prefer? I got to tell you, Tanner, the Telluride.
I think
the Telluride is one of the best in the segment right now. And the sales numbers prove it. Telluride and Palisade are selling really, really well. I think following those two, another really good contender is the Highlander. But honestly, if it were my money, Telluride.
RICHMC says, what should we read into the Pilot Sport 4S being available to fit a 23-inch SUV wheel, but not on the 18s on the back of a 996? I think you're referring to our GLS piece that we recently released. Wow.
23-inch wheel. This tells you that all the money's going into performance SUVs is what it tells you, but yeah.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, and that is follow the money, because the margins on those are probably a little bit more, and those are what people are buying. Not that they're not for 996 18-inch tires back there, but the people doing that probably aren't using them up.
Well, there's far more. It's crazy to think about. There is a bigger market for a 23-inch wide tire on a brand new GLS than there is for a person buying an old 996 tire.
I hate to say it. It's the old tried and true cliche, but follow the money in anything. Apply the, now let's see, when it comes down to earnings, money, what's the difference? Yep. Okay. That's what's selling. That's what people are buying. It's ties into that.
Side rant real quick.
$500 a tire.
Yeah, side rant real quick. Do me a favor. There's a little Tylenol-shaped thing on your tires. If you have a sports car you rarely ever drive and you think, oh, these tires have got years left, what's the date inside that Tylenol shape? It actually is. It's the week and the year.
Mm-hmm.
So the first two numbers are the week of the year that it was made. If your tires are more than 5 or 6 years old, I don't care if they're worn out. Let me give you some advice. They're worn out. It's time to get new tires.
Let me tell you, they're worn out.
It's time.
Ted Adam Green says, what are my thoughts on the i20N from Hyundai? And do we have any insight if we will get it as the Accent N or Kona N? I think it's brilliant. If you haven't seen the i20N, Hyundai's doing their thing again. They're applying their N magic to one of their smallest hot hatches. It's turbocharged 1.6 liter four cylinder, 203 foot pounds of torque, 201 horsepower, something like that. Manual gearbox, LSD, and front wheel drive, and it just looks tight and fun. It just looks like fun sitting there, ready to go. I love this thing. I wish this was what people would be buying in America, but they're buying SUVs with 23-inch 325 series tires on the back.
It's crazy. They're really good, but oh my gosh.
They've got all these modes, normal, eco, sport, N, and N custom settings. You can tweak the engine response and the ESC and the exhaust noise and the steering and all. I think they're brilliant, but that's what people are buying in Europe. They're smaller roads. Yeah. We got space here. We got the parking space. Although I think architects hate cars. I bring this up to Todd and Chance all the time. We run into a new, you know, we're parking over here, and I think, why do architects hate cars? You just want to park as many of them as you can get in here. And the door, that's why people have door dings, and it just bugs me. So
no consideration for the fact that, you know.
Listening to this, I'm curious as to your take on cars. Does it always just have to be as many fit into this space as possible? Just give me space around my car, my baby. I just want to...
The Paul Parking School of Architecture.
Yes!
Opening this fall.
Yes! There's space between the cars.
We schedule and plan and design for cars first, and we build a building around the fact that the cars have got space.
I mean, no slight to architects anywhere. I just think some of these projects I see, it's like, really? Like... That's the space you gave me for my car?
They got done and then decided on cars. That certainly does happen, I think.
And that really just, it varies by continent. It's amazing. Thank you guys so much, as always, for all your amazing questions. Please write to us with your social media questions. We put out the call on Mondays and Thursdays, usually, when we're traveling, when we're not traveling, for social media questions. But also, write to us everydaydrivertv@gmail.com for all your car debates and your Topic Tuesdays and your car conclusions. Really appreciate it. We're always looking forward to next time. Cheers, everyone.